Hi, folks. Welcome back to our podcast, which has a name. It's called The Unbelievers, taken, of course, from Thomas Covenant, who is the prime unbeliever. So these are the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever, the first book of which is Lord Fowell's Bane. I'm Cams, a constant reader, and I'm here with my pal Barge.
Hey, folks.
So we've had a look through the first three chapters of Lord Fowell's Bane. This is might even be my fifth read. Not sure, I don't keep count, but it's been a few. And of course, this is Barge's first read.
It's my first read, and I've only read the first three chapters. I came, as I mentioned in the intro, completely clean to this, so with no background knowledge. So I got into it, and I was carried along through the first two chapters, kind of wondering how deep it's going to go and whether I'm even going to be able to take it. But yeah, because I mean, I'm going along just first of all wondering, why is he being treated like that? And then finding out at the end of the first chapter. And then you're okay with me carrying on like that? Or am I jumping ahead for you?
No, but no, what I'll just put out there is that anyone listening to this who's not read the first three chapters, you might want to do that first. Because obviously we're going to be discussing the details of what happens.
Yeah. So I think then we just assume that people have read it, right? So,
yeah.
So I came into this, and then I find that he's getting these reactions from people, and then that he's a leper. All right. And then the experience of leprosy itself in the second chapter, which, I mean, is brilliantly delivered, you know, and... yeah, like I said, I was wondering, like, how much more of this can I take?
Yeah, what's interesting is that the first chapter's 8 pages, and it doesn't mention that he's a leper until the very last line, or the penultimate line in the chapter. "Don't touch me," Covenant murmured to the grip on his arm. "I'm a leper."
Right, right.
So you're aware of some health issues he's going through, but you're not entirely sure what's going on.
The very first scene is of the mother who gets her child away from him because of something about him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that just carries on and gets added to from various angles.
Yeah.
And you get a sense of not only that he's an outcast, but that he's really detested in some way.
Like,
so what has he done?
Mm.
You know, and I think there's mention of Joan, his wife and his child, you know, and that too with, you know, them looking at, or at least her looking at him with revulsion. So so it really builds up, and as a reader, you're wondering, why? What has he done? What is this?
Yeah.
And then it's revealed at the end of the first chapter.
Yeah, it's really well done. It describes him in the very first paragraph as a grey, gaunt man who strode down the centre of the walk like a mechanical derelict. So that's when the woman pulls her child out of his way. And we get that famous line, "Beware, outcast, unclean," which becomes his kind of mantra.
Oh, I see, to get people out of the way.
It's how he thinks of himself as an outcast, unclean. And he uses that when he goes to pay his bill at the telephone company. Because what's happening is that the local community are ostracising him and trying to keep him out of the town, basically. So somebody anonymously pays his phone bill so that he doesn't have to go in and pay it. and that pisses him off.
Something awful, because he's then this growing realization that nothing is left open for him.
Mm.
He mentions his rage a lot, and yeah, I find that comes up in the next chapter, though, when he's in the leprosarium.
But he uses his anger as a tool for survival. And the doctor who teaches him how to live as a leper gives him all the instructions about his VSEs, visual surveillance of extremities, which becomes another ritual for him.
Yes, and he's very, very disciplined about it.
Yeah, he is. And also with the shaving discipline, where he's obviously vulnerable to cuts and scrapes, anything that can get infected. Mm. I mean, not only could be fatal, but probably would be fatal. And so as a ritual, he found his old straight razor. Its long stainless steel blade gleamed like a leer in the fluorescent light of his bathroom. But he stropped it deliberately, lathered his face, braced his timorous bones against the sink, and set the edge to his throat. How's that for descriptive writing?
Mm-hmm. He also takes a penknife with him, huh? And when he feels his concentration or tension wavering, then he takes it out and touches the tip to his wrist just to remind himself and bring himself back. So, I mean, what I was struck by is the willpower. So, I mean, what he does develop, and maybe he uses his anger as a tool to, as the engine for the development of this willpower, but the strength, the discipline, I mean, in following the VSEs and also in going to all these lectures and seminars where, you know, they're spouting the same old stuff that he's having to live, and then his dreams, you know. So, you know, the messages in the dreams, which are also the instructions.
Mm.
And then his anger drives him on. But it somehow, because you see, in the Indian tradition, right, going back, it's the tapasya, it's the disciplines that open up the magic of the universe and provide answers. So, I mean, there was something of that going on for me.
Mm, interesting. Because, Stephen Donaldson's father was a doctor and he worked in India. And he was involved with leprosy. That's how the author came to know about this.
Right.
So, Covenant lived in India. Not Covenant. Stephen Donaldson lived in India as a young man. Or a young teenager, I guess, with his father.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, because I did the same. I lived in India until I was a teenager. And I do remember seeing lepers. And I do remember seeing people who would get to the stage where the leprosy is manageable, but they're scarred, you know, either blind or limbs and things like that. And I do have memories of that. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the stranger, the beggar in the ochre robe. What are your thoughts on that? What do you remember?
Right. So the beggar comes after he's related his 6 or 7 months spent. As it were, in preparing himself for the world, right?
Mm.
So, he's done his discipline, he's done his self-study, he's built up his attention and skills and awareness. So he's perhaps ready for the next phase. And then the beggar seems to then be the one that carries this message of magic that has been triggered by his disciplinary efforts. And certainly the message from the beggar when he finally gets to read it in the bank is it's a pretty mystical kind of one, huh?
It is. It's cryptic.
And I mean, yeah. So he's a representative of this world who has to take on a representative of another world in a fight to the death, and should he be defeated, not only he, but his world will disappear.
Mm.
And it takes place in, as it were, a different realm.
So it's the first time we've had an indication of possible worlds.
Right. And also for me, this was the point at which I realised, right, okay, so it's not going to be like 10 volumes of, you know, the agony of a guy going through the experience of leprosy.
No. No. It poses a moral question at the end of this cryptic letter that he gets handed, which... or ethics, as Covenant snorted to himself. Who the hell makes these things up?
Hmm,
so it's a question of morality or ethics. I won't read the whole thing out, but it's...
I read an excerpt, just...
Yeah, well, the bit where it talks about other worlds, it says, the man refuses to believe that what he is told is true. So we've got the word believe there.
And
talking about the unbeliever...
Right. And the implication is that if you don't believe it, then when the adversary comes, you will be ill-prepared because you don't believe that it's going to happen or worthy or that it's real.
Mm.
And so you will be defeated. And, which is more courageous, to actually take it on? Or to pretend that it's not.
Mm.
Something along those lines?
Yeah. So we've got belief. He refuses to believe that what he is told is true. He asserts that he is either dreaming or hallucinating and declines to be put in the false position of fighting to the death where no real danger exists. He is implacable in his determination to disbelieve the apparent situation and does not defend himself when he is attacked by the champion of the other world. Question. Is the man's behaviour courageous or cowardly? This is the fundamental question of ethics. So it's a bit Nietzschean in a sense. It's like the philosophical idea of the Übermensch, that if you can act in a way immorally because you don't believe that there are consequences, or if you act in a way... If you're in a world that you don't believe in and you act in a particular way, is that unethical? Because there are no consequences, because it's not real?
I think there's also another interesting angle where we can zoom in on the word belief itself.
Mm.
So, I mean, I don't believe that I have two legs.
Right.
I know it.
Yes,
right?
It's a fact.
Well, I mean, it's within my living experience, it is an unassailable fact. Nobody can convince me that it's not the case unless I abdicate my own whatever sense of judgment about myself, right? But if I have a belief, then surely I'm kind of uncertain. I don't actually really know. I choose to put my chips there.
Mm.
But do I really know?
Well, the unavoidable question that we're going to get to, we might as well get to it now, is the idea of the simulation, the Matrix idea, that if we're living in a simulation, then is anything actually real?
I think, maybe we can ask ourselves, how do we know that anything is real? What is it that tells us that anything could even be real? It's our experience, right?
It's our experience, but it's also our biological makeup. Our retinas are able to perceive light frequencies and translate it into objects.
Right, and then that forms the subject matter of our experience.
Yes. So if you experience a situation in a dream, and that's recorded into your memory, is that any less real than something that happens when you're awake? Maybe this is getting to the root of what keeps me coming back to these books. It's going to be difficult to talk about these books much further without going into alcoholism, which for me, some of you might know, has been part of my life, including blackouts. And this is something I always used to ponder back in those days when I'm in blackout, but I'm still up and about and functioning. Where am I? Is what's happening. Am I responsible for my actions, first of all? And secondly, are they actually real? Maybe that's what keeps me coming back to these books.
Yeah, well, that's a very fundamental thing about life, right? How do we know what we think we know?
Yeah.
I mean, without that, then we only say that this is real or that is real. What actually tells us? I mean, is this because everyone accepts that it's real? You see, it's not such an obvious statement that one can compare one set of inverted commas reality with another, I think. But I do think that experience, because that's fundamental, that's primary. Everything is experienced.
But if you experience something in a dream?
That's experience. I mean, the building blocks of experience are kind of the same. I mean, if I have an experience of fear in a dream, then the details may be different. But, I mean, the quality of that experience is still recognisably fear, which I would experience in waking, right?
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know, it seems to me anyway that experience is a way of ascertaining something of reality.
So is that why Covenant has these rituals with the penknife and the shaving to experience the cold bosom of reality?
For him, what is reality? I think the doctor said to him, right, you're going to have to live with leprosy being the primary reality of your life.
Yeah.
24/7, 365, basically. Yeah. So I guess, in this case, right.
Yeah, and he accepts it.
He does. Remember when he's asked, well, why don't you end it?
Yeah.
That would be too easy.
And that's the message he gets from the leper in the leprosarium, who's got a more advanced stage
Yeah.
And he says to him, end it now.
Oh, yeah, right, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And, I mean, he's got that kind of thing of defiance, right? When someone tells him to do something, he kind of says, well, F you, man, I'm not going to. Because even when the big dark figure at the end of chapter 3 is kind of trying to get him to pray to me, right?
Yeah.
And when he belittles him too much, Thomas Covenant has had enough and tells him effectively to fuck off. Yeah. And then the guy realizes that he's gone too far.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's got that obstinacy and that defiance, which with the anger kind of
good words to describe him, obstinacy and defiance. Yeah, he's definitely got those in spades. So we're looking at chapter 2 here when he's having the conversation with the beggar, and he doesn't put change into the beggar's bowl. He puts his wedding ring into the beggar's bowl, which symbolises the anger he feels at his wife and son having left him. And it's also quite a magnanimous gesture, in a sense, because it's a valuable item. But the beggar returns the ring to him. And I think that's a very interesting scene. He says, that's worth more than a few coins, and he stamped away. And the beggar shouts, wait! The word carried such authority that Covenant stopped again. He stood still, husbanding his rage, until he felt the man's hand on his arm. And then he turned and looked into pale blue eyes as blank as if they were still studying the secret fire of the sun. The old man was tall with power. A sudden insecurity, a sense of proximity to matters he did not understand, disturbed Covenant. But he pushed it away. Don't touch me. I'm a leper. What a line.
Yeah, right.
So the old man was tall with power. So we've no idea who this guy is. He's just described as a beggar in an ochre robe.
But you see, I think another clue that he's some kind of, as it were, cosmic level messenger, right? Once he's delivered his message, the interaction is finished, his countenance becomes weaker. So the description of the beggar, then it changes. He's like begins to look old and feeble, and you see it kind of his energy is kind of dissipated, as if he's kind of blossomed in his deliverance of the message, and now can kind of disappear. At least that's what I.
So he's done the job he came to do. And he says to Covenant, why not destroy yourself? And Covenant says, that's too easy.
And then he also gives him the thing of, you will not fail.
Yeah, he says, take back the ring, be true, you need not fail.
That's right, you need not fail, right.
That's the line that was italicized earlier on.
Right, yeah.
So that line's repeated.
Yeah, and it comes back to him at a crucial moment towards the end of chapter 3, sometime when he's in a state and... Or it might be a nightmare or something, and this line comes back to him.
The beggar says that I was incorrect there. That's the first time we read the line. It's then italicised on the next page when he's lying in bed. His self-protections die like this. He became aware of a huge blackness which stood behind the sunlight and the gleaming store windows and the shriek of tyres. So this is the scene where things are about to change. As the light and the asphalt against his head seemed to be nothing more than paintings on a black background, and now the background asserted itself, reached in and bore him down. Blackness radiated through the sunlight like a cold beam of night. He thought that he was having a nightmare. Absurdly, he heard the old beggar saying, "Be true, you need not fail."
That's it, that's it. Oh yeah, it's over here, not later on, yeah, right.
So that's the end of chapter two.
Right. And then, my goodness.
Mm.
I mean, to me, it's like, it's a near-death experience, right? So he's crossing the road, and the police car is coming towards him. And he like knows or whatever that, you know, he doesn't try to escape. He even feels he's falling before he's even been hit.
Mm. So it's not made clear whether he is hit.
Right, it's not made clear.
No. So, to all intents and purposes, as far as we know, he could be dead. And he's now in the afterlife when he comes to.
Right, and there's that theme of the red police car light, which, you know, comes and fades back and, you know, morphs into something else.
Yeah.
So that was what kind of, to me, suggested also that, you know, the near-death experience. So, I mean, for me, yeah, I thought it was somewhere in I didn't think he was dead, but I thought it was, yeah, this is the kind of shift to a different dimension.
It's like the trope of going into the light as being death.
Right, and also, I mean, you know, there are so many accounts of near-death experiences, and they all are similar in certain senses too. To what he seems to be going through, at least in some ways.
So the light metaphor or motif continues into chapter 3 until the two flaming spots become eyes. The next instant he heard laughter, high, shrill, glee, full of triumph and old spite. This is excellent writing, man. The voice crowed like some malevolent rooster heralding the dawn of hell, and Covenant's pulse trembled at the sound. "I've done it," the voice cackled. "Aye, mine," it shrilled away into laughter again. So here we have a new character, Drool Rockworm.
Yeah. yeah, pleasant kind of character, huh?
I always imagined Drool Rockworm as a wee hunchback, but he's described as being quite tall and gangly. Interesting.
No, I didn't understand too much of what was going on, except that he'd found a staff which he was wanting to claim for himself. And it seemed as if he was going to kill Thomas Covenant, or at least do something to him. And then there was the big intervention from...
Yeah, so he's got the staff and he says, "Mine, my staff, you saw, I called him, you saw." So why is Drool Rockworm calling Thomas Covenant?
So he was calling Thomas Covenant.
Yeah. And that's why he said, at the beginning he says, "I did it, I did it."
Okay, I see.
So he's used the staff as a tool.
I see, he's used it. He didn't find the staff. Okay.
Oh, that's not made clear, or is it?
Well, that's the impression I had, but, I mean, yeah, I've only read up to chapter 3.
So, we're told at the end of chapter 3 that the staff had been lost.
Right, yeah.
During the ritual of desecration.
By Kevin
Landwaster. I always found that an interesting name for a fantasy book character, Kevin.
Right, so about why he might have called Thomas Covenant. Well, I mean, we get to know that he's got some kind of wild powers or wild magic, and that this is what prevents, which this is what protects him against the big dark guy. And that is the energy that the big dark guy covets as well.
Yes.
So there is something about him. But, I mean, yeah.
So is Drill Rockworm acting on the orders of Lord Foul, do you think?
So Lord Foul is the big dark guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He has multiple names, which he gives us.
Yes, right.
He introduces himself as Lord Foul to Thomas Covenant.
Right. Okay. Right, so... I don't know. Clearly, what's his name? Who found the staff?
Drool.
Clearly Drool thought he was on to a big thing for which he was going to get a lot of credit.
Yeah.
And then he was miffed about it being taken, about Thomas Covenant being taken off him, until he was told that he could do something or the other, and that seemed to placate him.
He gets to keep the staff.
Is that what it is, right?
I think so, yeah.
And then doesn't the story come back to that slightly later on in the chapter, saying how dangerous that would be? Doesn't Lord Bane himself say how dangerous that would be, and how all the worlds were kind of going to be destroyed? And that's what this is where I got a bit confused,
right,
to be honest.
I'm just looking at his names here. So he introduces himself as Lord Foul the Despiser to the Giants of Seereach, Satan's Heart and Soul Crusher. The Ramen named me Fangthane. In the dreams of the Bloodguard, I am Corruption. But the people of the land call me the Grey Slayer. So we've just had a lot of different people introduced there.
Hmm.
The Bloodguard, you've no idea who they are yet.
No.
The Giants, well, I mean, you know they're Giants, but we don't know anything about them. The Ramen, who are they? Don't know.
Yeah. Kevin only have a notion that... he's got something to do with the staff, that he's Lord Bane's big adversary, and that I got the sense that he's got some connection with Thomas Covenant, some kind of protective thing, maybe. I don't know.
Interesting. Hmm. See, this is good. I like to get ideas and predictions from you. At this early stage, it's really fun for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it talks of Kevin Landwaster, it talks of the ritual of desecration, so it's bringing in a lot just in these few pages. It mentions Kevin's lore, it mentions the Lords of Revelstone, it mentions the Earth Friends, it gives you the names of Kirill Threndor, which is where the cave is, that the staff is found.
Right.
And it discusses how Lord Kevin had so much lore that has been lost. So I haven't underlined that section, but there is a section where it talks about the levels of lore, or the wards. I don't think it calls them wards, but there are different levels of lore, and the current Lords of Revelstone don't have it. So when the ritual of desecration occurred, which is why Kevin is called Kevin Landwaster, because he destroyed the land, he was tricked into doing that by Lord Foul. So all this is discussed in the section, and it also talks of some of the older generations of lords. So it gives you some of the family tree. High Lord Prothol, son of Dwillian. He's the current lord of the Council of Revelstone. Covenant's given a task to deliver a message.
That's right.
He's got to take this message to the lords. And of course, he's no idea who these lords of Revelstone are.
Right. Interesting. I think, you know, Cams, that one of the reasons I wouldn't have been into fantasy as a youngster is, I suppose, I'd have resisted the creations of alternative worlds when I hadn't yet explored this one. I think that's fundamentally what it would have been. Because I feel vestiges of that coming up just now, you know. All these introductions of, you know, names and places and rituals and things and whole kind of worlds being kind of created. But I'm much more open and into it. And understand, you know, it's just a question of terminology, which one gets used to as we go along.
Yeah, but I do remember that these books are written by people who live in our world, and so there's going to be a lot of allegory and things that we can learn about our own world through reading about these other worlds.
That's what makes it interesting for me now. Where I can make those expanded connections, whereas I wouldn't have been in the state to do so in my teens or 20s, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think this, particularly chapter 3, I think is very, very dense with information. I think you did well just to get through it and take from it what you did, because as one who's coming back to this with the knowledge that I have, I'm quite blown away with how much is in this chapter. It's very, very dense. So let's look at this sentence here. When Lord Fowl says to Thomas Covenant, "Reject the doom that my enemy has created for you. You will not have many chances to repent." And my enemy is capitalised. So who's Lord Fowl's enemy?
Kevin?
Kevin's gone.
I mean, huh?
Oh, well, it could be because it talks in the past tense that my enemy has created for you. It says, but Kevin's gone.
I'm not clear that Kevin's dead. Is that what you're saying?
Together we uttered the ritual of desecration. Ah, the fool. He was already enslaved to me and knew it not. Proud of his lore, he did not know that the very law which he served preserved me through that cataclysm. Though all but a few of his own people and works were stricken into death.
Right. Yeah, this is where, you know, I got a sense of, you know, multiple layers being built into the situation. And, you know, I didn't try, and because there's no point, you know, intellectually following. I just made a point that, yeah, there's, you know, or an observation that, you know, there's a lot going on. And I mean, it's just too simplistic to equate, what's his name, Lord Bane with the devil and, I don't know, his enemy with, you know, the force of good. I think it's far too simplistic. And even when one of his titles was what, something Satan Stamper Outer or something like that. It wasn't...
Satan's Heart and Soul Crusher.
Right, exactly. Is he a heart and soul crusher for Satan?
That's the name that the giants give him.
Right, I see. But, you know, you see, it could work both ways, right? Or he could be the one that crushes Satan's heart and soul. Right. But you know, there is darkness, and later on he talks about stamping out hope.
So towards the end, it mentions the Illyrth Stone on the last page. This is another bane which Drool seeks. He searches for the Illyrth Stone. If he becomes its master, there will be woe for low and high alike until time itself falls.
If who becomes its master?
Drool. Drool Rogue
right,
One.
Drool. Right, yeah. Exactly. Exactly, right.
So Drool has the staff and he's looking for the Illyrth Stone.
And Bane considers it worth swapping Thomas Covenant for that possibility.
Lord Foul.
Lord Foul.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, Lord Foul, yeah, right. It's Lord Foul's Bane.
Yeah.
So he considers that a worthwhile swap. So that wild energy must be like really wild. I mean, because it's being compared with, you know, the magnitude of all worlds being destroyed, like.
Yeah. And time itself. So that's an interesting little nugget there. Do not fail with my message, Groveler. You have met Drool. Do you relish dying in his hands? One word more, Phil said, a final caution. Do not forget whom to fear at the last.
Hmm.
So that's us at the end of chapter 3. Are you excited to continue?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about excited, but I'm intrigued. I mean,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, looking forward to this unfolding. It's been all right, this exercise and this format and this way of kind of bouncing it off, and that'll only get more polished, I suppose, as the episodes carry on and the understanding of the format of presentation and the content kind of, you know, just come more into sync, I guess.
Yeah. I think we could have done a whole episode on just chapter 3, really. There's so much in it. But it's challenging for me to rein in my knowledge.
Right.
I mean, I think I'm doing okay.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's for people who've read the whole thing to know.
Yeah.
And I'm just firing in with just, I don't know, whatever connections I'm making, you know, without any sense. So, yeah, that's the way it is.
So for the next one, we'll look at chapter 4, Kevin's Watch. We've got chapter 5, Mythal Stone Down. And if that's where a certain thing happens, that's definitely a place to stop.
Rightio.
Yeah.
Okay, chapters 4 and 5 it is then.
Excellent. So we'll be recording once a week, publishing probably on a Friday. I've just set up the domain and the hosting, etc. So if you want to feedback to us, that would be amazing. We will be publishing at theunbelievers.co. That's our domain. And we're going to be setting up a Patreon. So if you want to go to patreon.com/theunbelievers, that would be a good way of supporting us. It's not set up yet as I record this, but it will be by the time you hear it. And if you're not already subscribed to The Unbelievers, now's the time to do it, folks. Make sure you never miss an episode. We're on basically every single podcast platform. iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, consider donating to our Patreon. We're entirely funded by Patreon donations, so each and every dollar or pound or yen or euro or whatever goes right back in. We appreciate everyone that gives and supports us. But there's another way to support us, and this is the most important thing we're going to ask our listeners to do this week. One of the biggest metrics for success for a new podcast is how many ratings and how many reviews you get coming out the gate. The most important time in a podcast life is the first 3 or 4 weeks. So, listeners, we need your help. If you enjoyed this episode, please go right now to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or wherever you're listening that has its own metric thing. Hit the 5-star button and write us a review. It honestly makes a huge difference, and that's the best way to support us right now. If we get a lot of very quick 5-star ratings and reviews, we move up some lists. People find us. If people search for Thomas Covenant in a podcatcher, it will be the first one that comes up. It's really key to us finding an audience, and we really appreciate all the help that you can give us. It's probably the most important ask that we'll make of you on this show. So, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Bye for now. Oh, and just a wee add-on here. I would like to just let you know that if you want to follow along, we've set up a read-along page using the Storygraph app. The Storygraph is a read-tracking website, and we really like it. It's a small team that runs it, and we have decided that we'd like to support that app. They have a read-along feature that looks perfect for our needs. So if you want to follow along with us, they will have discussion forums on there, so we'll be able to chat about each chapter as we publish the episodes. And, I think it's just a good place to do it. So you will need an account in order to participate, but it doesn't cost you anything to set up an account over on the Storygraph. So go and do that if you want to follow, and we'll see you there, hopefully. Cheers, bye.